on. This is based on this book, This is Water, by David Foster Wallace. Someone told me about this book a few years ago, and I picked it up and got it and read it and went, oh my God, this is incredible. And then just recently I picked it up again. And I went, oh, this is a Dharma talk. Even though actually what this was, interestingly enough, this what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you most of this because this short book. This is was a commencement speech that he gave, David Foster Wallace gave, at a liberal arts college. So if you see, there's a few places where he's talking about, you know, liberal arts students and how they relate to the world. And that's the context of this. But actually, it's pretty much Dharma, though he would probably not call it that. anyhow, so I'm just going to start by reading some of this, and then at certain places in the text, I'm going to stop and comment on what he's written, and then and put it into perhaps more Buddhist Theravada context. Or that's the plan anyway. So here we go. So think of this as a Dharma talk and story time all rolled into one. Okay. Okay, so here we go. This is the beginning of the book. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" The story thing turns out to be one of the better conventions of this genre, commencement exercises. But if you're worried that I plan to present myself here as a wise old fish explaining what water is to you younger fish, please don't be. I am not a wise old fish. I second that. The immediate point of the fish story is merely that the obvious, ubiquitous, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. Stated as an English sentence, of course, this is just a banal platitude. But the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult life and existence, banal platitudes can have a life or death importance. Of course, the main requirement of speeches like this is that I am supposed to talk about your liberal arts education's meaning, to try to explain why the degree you're about to receive has actual human value instead of just a material payoff. So let's talk about the single most pervasive cliche in the commencement speech genre, which is that a liberal arts education is not so much about filling you up with knowledge as it is about, quote, teaching you how to think. If you, like me, as a college student, you've never liked hearing this, and you tend to feel a bit insulted by the claim that you need somebody to actually teach you how to think. Since the fact that you even got admitted to a college this good seems like proof that you already know how to think. But I'm going to posit to you that the liberal arts cliche turns out not to be insulting at all, because the really significant education in thinking that we're supposed to get in this place, in a place like this, isn't really about the capacity to think, but rather about the choice of what to think about. If your complete freedom of choice regarding what to think about seems obvious, too obvious to waste time talking about, I'd ask you to think about fish and water and to bracket, just for a few minutes, your skepticism about the value of the totally obvious. Here's another didactic little story. There are these two guys sitting together in a bar in a remote Alaskan wilderness. One guy's religious and the other's an atheist, and they're arguing about the existence of God with that special intensity that comes after about the fourth beer. And the atheist says, look, it's not like I don't have actual reasons for not believing in God. It's not like I haven't ever experimented with the whole God in prayer thing. Just last month, I got caught off away from the camp in that terrible blizzard, and I couldn't see a thing, and I was totally lost, and it was 50 below, and so I did. I tried it. I fell to my knees in the snow and cried out, God, if there is a God, I'm lost in this blizzard, and I'm going to die if you don't help me. And now in the bar, the religious guy looks at the atheist all puzzled. Well, then you must believe now, he said. After all, here you are alive. The atheist rolls his eyes like the religious guy is a total simp. No, man, all that happened was that a couple of Eskimos just happened to come wandering by, and they showed me the way back to the camp. It's easy to turn this story, to run this story through a kind of standard liberal arts analysis. The exact same experience can mean two completely different things to two different people, given those people's two different belief templates and two different ways of constructing meaning from experience. Because we prize tolerance and diversity of belief, nowhere in our liberal arts analysis do we want to claim that one guy's interpretation is true and the other guy's interpretation is false or bad, which is fine, except that we also never end up talking about just where these individual templates and beliefs come from, meaning where they come from inside the two guys. And if a person's most basic orientation toward the world and the meaning of his experience were somehow automatically hardwired, like height or shoe size, or absorbed from culture, like language, as if how we construct meaning were not actually a personal, intentional choice of conscious decision. Plus, there's the matter of arrogance. The non-religious guy is totally obnoxiously confident in his dismissal of the possibility that the Eskimos had anything to do with this prayer for help. True, there are plenty of religious people who seem arrogantly certain of their own interpretations too. They're probably even more repulsive than atheists, at least to most of us here. But the fact is, the religious dogmatist problem is exactly the same as the story's atheists: arrogance, blind certainty, a closed-mindedness that's like an imprisonment so complete that the prisoner doesn't even know he's locked up. The point here is that I think this is one part of what the liberal arts mantra of teaching me how to think is really supposed to mean: to just be a little less arrogant, to have some critical awareness about myself and my certainties. Because a huge percentage of the stuff that I tend to be automatically certain of is, it turns out, totally wrong and deluded. I've learned that the hard way, as I predict you graduates will too. So what's he talking about here, this first section of the speech? He's talking about right view, the first step on the Eightfold Path, right? He's talking about how we have to, if we're going to go in the correct direction, we have to see things clearly. We have to understand the parameters of the situation. But like the fish who didn't know what water is, often we're making decisions based on view that is, doesn't take in the whole picture. Let me read a little bit of Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight, here. He's talking about how what we get attached to, right? The second great attachment is to our own opinions and views. We have so many opinions about things, so many preconceptions. Attachment to view is such a great bondage. It keeps us from seeing how things really are. It filters reality through the colored glasses of our own particular conditioning. A great meditation master from Thailand, when asked what was the greatest hindrance his students had, answered, opinions, views and ideas about all things, about themselves, about practice, about the teachings of the Buddha. Their minds are filled with opinions about things. They are too clever to listen to others. It's like a cup of water in a cup. If a cup is filled with dirty, stale water, it is useless. Only after the old water is thrown out can the cup become useful. You must empty your minds of opinions. Then you will see. Then there's a quote from the third Zen patriarch. Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. One of my favorite quotes from the third Zen patriarch. Do not seek truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. If we let go of this attachment, the whole Dharma will be revealed. Everything will be there. We have to let go of our preconceived ideas of how things are, of how we would like things to be, letting go of the attachment to our cherished opinions. This is the second of the great bonds which keeps us from going around on the wheel of samsara. So this is a real problem that we all have. And most of the time, if we're not careful, we're not conscious of it at all. We're basically filled with all these views and opinions based on, you know, our upbringing, our culture, what kind of work we do, who we hang out with. I mean, the list of ways we get views is endless, right? And when we don't open to the broader perspective, we don't see that we're actually swimming in water. Then we start to make decisions based on this narrow set of parameters that doesn't take into account everything. We start to believe that our views are the correct views, and those other people with other views, they must be wrong. And this is basically the trouble in our world today. The primary trouble in our world today is people get attached to their views and opinions. And they aren't open to seeing other people's views and opinions. They just can't let that in because it's too disturbing, or because they're lazy, or because they don't see that there's just fish. They don't see the water. They can't open that wide. So anyhow, back to John Foster Wallace. So that's the first part of Dharma in this. And then, so he's going on. Here's one example of the utter wrongness of something I tend to be automatically sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence. We rarely think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it is so socially repulsive, but it's pretty much the same for all of us deep down. It's our default setting, hardwired into our boards at birth. Think about it. There's no experience you've had that you were not at the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is there in front of you or behind you, to the left or the right of you, on your TV, on your monitor, or whatever. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but your own are so immediate, urgent, and real. You get the idea. But please don't worry that I'm getting ready to preach to you about compassion or other directness or so-called virtues. This is not a matter of virtue. It's a matter of my choosing to do the work of somehow altering and getting free of my natural, hardwired default settings, which is to be deeply and literally self-centered, and to see and interpret everything through this lens of self. People who can adjust their natural default settings this way are often described as being, quote, well adjusted, which I suggest to you is not an accidental term. So here he's talking about central part of the Buddhist teachings, which is the whole teaching on not self. We see everything as me at the center, and me being this permanent thing at the center that everything else is revolving around in some sense. Let me read a little bit more of Joseph Goldstein here. The force of the bonds and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome action, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion, for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. This is the central teaching of the Buddhas that's the hardest to understand, because we're so sure that I'm a separate self. This is me, Barry, over there, and that's you folks over there, and I'm separate from you. It's just like so hardwired, as they use his term. It's just so deeply ingrained in our thinking. And it's the center of a lot of our problems. And I want to quote one of my teachers, Carol Wilson. I'll tell you, Carol Wilson is not your normal Dharma teacher. She's pretty wild, actually. I appreciate the fact that she's like that, that she can sort of hang out there. So here this quote comes from a Dharma talk I heard, and she was basically talking about this very issue of self-centeredness and what a problem it was. And what she said was, we all, almost without exception, have the following view. I'm a little piece of shit that the world revolves around. And this is like, yeah, you know, it's just such, I'll repeat that. I'm a little piece of shit that the world revolves around. This is where we get caught over and over and over again. Not only are we deeply embedded in this sense of self, but we also are deeply caught in blaming this self, in beating ourselves up about how unskillful this self is, how this self isn't any good, blah, 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 blah. So it's a double whammy, right? We're caught up in both the idea of a separate self and that this separate self isn't any good. This is the central problem of our culture for many people, many, many people, to a greater or lesser degree, but it's always at some layer, it's there. And so it's something we have to be aware of all the time. Okay. So to continue with John Foster Wallace. Okay, given the academic setting here, an obvious question is how much of this work of adjusting our default setting involves actual knowledge or intellect? The answer, not surprisingly, is that it depends on what kind of knowledge we're talking about. Probably the most dangerous thing about an academic education, at least in my own case, is that it enables my tendency to over-intellectualize stuff, to get lost in abstract thinking instead of simply paying attention to what is going on in front of me. Sounds like Buddhism to me. Instead of paying attention to what's going on inside me. As I'm sure you guys know by now, it's extremely difficult to stay alert and attentive instead of getting hypnotized by the constant monologue inside your head. What we don't yet know are the stakes of this struggle. In the 20 years since my own graduation, I have come gradually to understand these stakes and to see that the liberal arts cliche about teaching you how to think was actually shorthand for a deep and important truth. Learning how to think really means learning how to exercise some control over how and what you think. One of my favorite themes, you might notice. It means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to and to choose how you construct meaning from experience. Because if you cannot or will not exercise this kind of choice in adult life, you will be totally hosed. Think of that old cliche about the mind being an excellent service but a terrible master. This, like many cliches, so lame and banal on the surface, actually expresses a great and terrible truth. It's not the least bit coincidental that adults who commit suicide with firearms nearly always shoot themselves in the head. And the truth is that most of these suicides are actually dead long before they pull the trigger. And I submit that this is the real value of our liberal arts education. It's supposed to be about how to keep from going through your comfortable, prosperous, respectable adult life dead, unconscious, a slave to your head and to your natural default settings of being uniquely, completely, imperially alone, day in and day out. That may sound like hyperbole or abstract nonsense. So let's get concrete. The plain fact is that you graduating seniors do not yet have any clue what day in, day out really means. There happens to be a whole large part of adult American life that nobody talks about in commencement speeches. One such part involves boredom, routine, and petty frustration. The parents and older folks here will know all too well what I'm talking about. By way of example, let's say it's an average adult day and you get up in the morning, go to your challenging white collar college graduate job, and you work hard for 9 or 10 hours. And at the end of the day, you're tired and you're stressed out. And all you want to do is go home and have a good supper and maybe unwind for a couple of hours, and then hit the rack early because you have to get up the next day and do it all again. But then you remember there's no food at home. You haven't had time to shop this week because of your challenging job. And so now after work, you have to get in your car and drive to the supermarket. It's the end of the workday and the traffic's very bad. So getting to the store takes much longer than it should. And when you finally get there, the supermarket is very crowded because of course it's the time of day when all the other people with jobs are also trying to squeeze in some grocery shopping, and the store is hideously, fluorescently lit and infused with soul-killing music or corporate pop, and it's pretty much the last place you want to be, but you can't just get in and quickly out. You have to wander all over the huge, overlit, crowded aisles to find the stuff you want, and you have to maneuver your junky cart through all of these other tired, hurried people with carts. And of course, there are also the glacially slow old people and the spacey people and the ADHD kids who are all block the aisle. And you have to grit your teeth and try to be polite and ask them to let you by. And eventually, finally, you get all your supper supplies, except now it turns out there aren't enough checkout lanes open, even though it's the end of the day rush. And so the checkout line is incredibly long, which is stupid and infuriating. But you can't take your fury out on the frantic lady working the register who is overworked at a job whose daily tedium and meaningless surpasses the imagination of any of us here at the prestigious college. But anyway, you finally get to the checkout line's front and you pay for your food and wait and get your check or card authenticated by a machine, and you get told, "Have a nice day," in a voice that is absolutely the voice of death. And then you have to take your creepy, flimsy plastic bags of groceries in your cart, with the one crazy wheel that pulls maddeningly to the left, all the way out through the crowded, bumpy, littery parking lot, and try to load the bags in your car in such a way that everything doesn't fall out of the bags and roll around in the trunk on the way home. And then you have to drive all the way home through slow, heavy, SUV intensive rush hour traffic, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone has done this, of course, but it hasn't yet been part of your graduate's life routine, day after week, after month, after year. But it will be, and many more dreary, annoying, seemingly meaningless routines besides. Except that's not the point. The point is that petty, frustrating crap like this is exactly where the work of choosing comes in. Because the traffic jams and crowded aisles and long checkered lines give me time to think, and if I don't make a conscious decision about how to think and what to pay attention to, I'm going to be upset and miserable every time I have to food shop, because my natural default settings is that situations like this are really all about me, about my hungriness and my fatigue and my desire to get home. And it's going to seem for all the world like everybody else is just in my way. And who the heck are all these people in my way? And look at how repulsive some of them are and how stupid and cow-like and dead-eyed and non-human they seem here in the checkout line. Or how annoying and rude it is that people are talking loudly on cell phones in the middle of the line. And look how deeply unfair this is. I've worked really hard all day and I'm starved and tired and I can't even get home to eat and unwind because all of these stupid people. Or, of course, if I'm a more socially conscious liberal arts form of my default settings, I can spend the time in the end of day traffic jam being angry and disgusted at all the huge, stupid, lane-blocking SUVs and Hummers and V12 pickup trucks burning their wasteful, selfish 40-gallon tanks of gas. And I can dwell on the fact that patriotic or religious bumper stickers always seem to be on the biggest, most disgustingly selfish vehicles driven by the ugliest, most inconsiderate and aggressive drivers who are usually talking on cell phones as they cut people off in order to get just 20 stupid feet ahead in the traffic jam. And I can think about how our children's children will despise us for wasting all the future's fuel and probably screwing up the climate, and how spoiled and stupid and selfish and disgusting we all are, and how it just sucks, and so on and so forth. Look, if I choose to think that this way, fine. Lots of us do. Except that thinking this way tends to be so easy and automatic, it doesn't have to be a choice. Thinking of this way is a natural default setting. It's the automatic, unconscious way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I am the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. The thing is, there are obviously different ways to think about these kinds of situations. In this traffic, all these vehicles stuck and idling in my way, it's not impossible that some of these people in SUVs have been in horrible auto accidents in the past and now find driving so traumatic that their therapist has all but ordered them to get a huge, heavy SUV so they can feel safe enough to drive. Or that Hummer that just cut me off is maybe being driven by a father whose little child is hurt or sick in the seat next to him, and he's trying to rush to the hospital. And he's in a way bigger, more legitimate hurry than I am. It is actually I am who am in his way. Or I can choose myself to consider the likelihood that everyone else in the supermarket checkout line is probably just as bored and frustrated as I am, and that some of these people actually have much harder, more tedious and painful lives than I do overall. And so on. So this is talking about one of my favorite themes in the Buddhist teachings. And that's that we don't have much or any control of what arises at our sense doors. You know, stuff just happens. Things arise through causes and conditions. You know, in this story's case, oh, the causes and conditions. Oh, I'm hungry, but I don't have any food in the house, so I got to go to the supermarket. And those were the causes and conditions that led him to this series of inputs at the sense doors. We can't control that. All we can control is how we react to these things. This is the primary reason behind practice. This is what practice allows us to do. It teaches us skillful means to work with our reactions to what's arising at our sense doors. Instead of just automatically falling into the, I like this, I don't like that, this is wrong, this is right, hardwired, using his terms again, way of thinking, which is often where we go. We just react automatically based on our views and opinions and our habits and our likes and our dislikes, our upbringing, who knows. We just react instead of going, maybe that guy in the car has got a little sick child next to him and he's rushing to the hospital and I should let him go ahead of me. Sort of, you know, that it's that way of thing. It's what this practice is about. It's shifting our view of things in this way by, in some sense, being more mindful of how we're reacting. Because it's our reactions that cause us to suffer. Not the stuff. The stuff is just the stuff. It's just stuff that's happening. It's how we react to that stuff that causes us to suffer. That's where the problem is, in the reaction. Not in the events themselves at all. I want to read a little bit. This is from a book called Satipatthana, which is a PhD thesis by this man named Analayo, who was a Theravada monk in Sri Lanka. And so it's kind of dense in terms of how it's written, but it's find myself referring back to this book many times, having read it many times, or sections of it. Not only does the Buddha's penetrating analysis of self provide a philosophical refutation of theories proposing a substantial or unchanging self, it also has an intriguing psychological relevance. Self as an independent and permanent entity is related to notions of mastery and control. Such notions of mastery, permanence, and inherent satisfactoriness to some degree parallel the concepts of narcissism and the ideal ego in modern psychology. It's this desire for control, that somehow I shouldn't have to put up with this stuff. that I shouldn't have to deal with this stuff. I should be able to control what's happening around me and, more importantly, what's happening up here in my mind. Or here in my mind, if I'm a good Buddhist, I should point to my heart, right? But it's like we somehow think we should be in control. And stuff just arises. Stuff's just there. Causes and conditions are such that things arise. The mind is just another sense door. All we can work with, the only thing we have is being able to work skillfully with our reactions to those things that are arising. That's the key. Okay. So back to John Foster Wallace again here. Again, please don't think I'm giving you moral advice, that I'm saying you are supposed to think this way, or that anyone expects you to just automatically do it, because it's hard. It takes will and mental effort. And if you're like me, some days you won't be able to do it, or else you just flat out don't want to. But most days, if you're aware enough to give yourself a choice, you can choose to look differently at this fat, dead-eyed, over-made-up lady who just screamed at her kid in the checkout line. Maybe she's not losing like this. Maybe she's been up 3 nights straight holding the hand of her husband who's dying of bone cancer. Or maybe she's the very lady in the low-wage clerk at the motor vehicle department who just yesterday helped your spouse resolve a nightmarish red tape problem through some small act of bureaucratic kindness. Of course, none of this is likely, but it's also not impossible. It just depends on what you want to consider. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is, and who and what is really important. If you want to operate on your default setting, then you, like me, probably will not consider possibilities that aren't pointless and annoying. But if you really learned how to think, how to pay attention, then you'll have other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer health type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars, compassion, love, the subsurface unity of all things. Not that that mystical stuff is necessarily true. The only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to try to see it. This, I submit, is the freedom of real education, of learning how to be well adjusted. You get to consciously decide what has meaning and what doesn't. You get to decide what to worship. Because here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power, and you will feel weak and afraid, and you'll need more, ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they are unconscious. They are the default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords in our tiny, skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the center of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom, and the kind that is most precious you will not hear much about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The real important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. This is real freedom. That is being taught how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost something infinite. I know that this stuff probably doesn't sound fun and breezy or grandly inspirational the way a commencement speech's central stuff should sound. What it is, so far as I can see, is the truth, with a whole lot of rhetorical stuff pared away. Obviously, you can think of it whatever you wish, but please don't dismiss it as some finger-wagging Dr. Laura sermon. None of this is about morality or religion or dogma or big fancy questions of life and death. The capital T truth is about life before death. It's about making it to 30 or maybe even 50 without wanting to shoot yourself in the head. It's about the real value of a real education, which has nothing to do with grades or degrees and everything to do with simple awareness. Awareness of what is so real and essential, so hidden in plain sight all around us, that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over. This is water. This is water. Those Eskimos might be much more than they seem. It is unimaginably hard to do this, to live consciously, adultly, day in and day out, which means yet another cliche is true. Your education really is the job of a lifetime, and it commences now. This is a wonderful book. So, this is what he's talking about here is how important it is to have mindfulness in daily life. That's really what this is all about. It's like if we can be mindful in how we live day to day, moment to moment, out when we're out there in the world, as opposed to sitting on our cushion or on retreat. That's the value of this practice. If we can only be mindful sitting on our cushion or in some retreat where we're separated from all of day to day stuff, that's nice. But it's really not that useful. But if we can be mindful moment to moment, day to day, as best we can, and we're all not going to be mindful all the time. We have to also accept that, that we're human beings, and it's just not always going to be perfect. It just isn't going to work out that way. Then we can actually get something out of life. And the other thing he's talking about is equanimity, that balance that the Buddha talks about over and over and over again, where we need to somehow keep our mind, body, spirit, whatever, balanced in such a way that we're not constantly swept away by the flood. You know, that image that the Buddha uses over and over again about the mind being like a flood, and we get caught in the flood and swept away. It's like that. And if we can somehow, using the practice as a raft, and it's part of the same simile, if we can use the practice as a raft to get us across the flood, that's what we want to do. Somehow not just get continually swept away by our hardwired, built-in ideas of how things are. Not ever seeing the water. Not ever seeing that we're being swept away, even. Because we're just too busy being sorry for ourselves or being angry or being whatever emotion we're caught with now. Whatever reaction we're in the midst of now. That's the value of the practice. And as he calls it, you know, the value of being able to actually think clearly. So I think that's all I have to say, which means I'm ending a little bit earlier than I normally do, but that's okay. Maybe I've provoked some thought and questions. And if that's the case, then I'm very, as always, very happy to hear what you have to say about what I've done tonight, and to ask questions, share thoughts, experiences, whatever it is you want to do. And because, once again, we're usually a small class, I can see you wave your hand if you want to speak, and then I'll say, just call out your name, and you can turn on your mic and speak. There's one person who isn't there. Sue, if you just want to turn on your mic and speak, that's okay too. Don't feel shy. Oh, Carolyn, this Carolyn's waving at me. Okay. We got six people, and two of them are Carolyns tonight. I don't know.
Yeah. Hello to the other Carolyn. Yeah, I was just going to say, it's really interesting, the topic you chose tonight, Barry, because I've recently had that experience of a series of events took place over the last week and a half, you know, that had nothing to do with me. But, you know, my reaction was to go into fear and doubt. And then, of course, that made me angry, and just this whole world that I went into over just stuff outside of my control that was unexpected. And I think the benefit of the practice, I get up every day and I do 30 minutes of meditation at least, day in and day out. And I generally enjoy it, but it's times like that that I was able to catch myself. I mean, I spent a day or two in the reaction and in the suffering. But my tolerance for that was way lower than premeditation. Like, I could kind of live in this reactive world and just keep perpetuating it on and on and on without a lot of awareness around. But I was so keenly aware of how crappy it felt to be doing that I couldn't tolerate it for as long. And I also was able, and I mean, your talk tonight really crystallized it for me. I was able to recognize, look, all this is a bunch of external stuff other people, you've got no control over it, and all I'm doing is spinning myself into a frenzy and reacting over stuff that I have no control over. And what if I, there's this beautiful quote by Pema Chodron, I'm the sky, the rest is weather, right? Like, what if it's just, I take a step back and it's like, these weather patterns are happening. Like, just be. Stop being angry about it. Stop being fearful about it. Stop getting in it about it. And so all I did is just let go of the external stuff and take ownership of my own reactions and kind of choose to react less, despite how annoying or frustrating or blah, 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 the story. And it was tremendously freeing, but I had to walk through the discomfort and the real suffering, you know, to realize I don't want to live like this. And my only choice is to stop reacting. So that's just what I wanted to share. Thank you. It was lovely.
Thank you. It sounds like putting practice into action skillfully to me. So other thoughts, questions, comments? Yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
I just wanted to say I really like the image of the raft keeping us float across the sea of our minds. So I just appreciated that metaphor.
Oh, that's a very famous sutta of the Buddha's. There's a whole thing called the raft. If you email me, I might be able even to send you a link to a reference to it someplace online. If you're curious, if you want to read the whole metaphor.
Okay.
If you don't want it, that's okay too. And I give a whole Dharma talk just on that image that I've given before several times. It's one of my favorite talks, actually. Maybe I'll give that again sometime. People are going, yeah, okay. Okay. Other comments, thoughts, questions? No. Oh, Sue's turned on her mic.
Yeah, Carolyn, you made me think of something that Ram Dass had said years ago. And I was at a whole afternoon thing. And the one thing that stood out in my mind was how we, you know, when we get spun off into, like you were saying, the stories and the drama and suffering and all that, he just said, oh, how we love our stories. And that comes back to me when I get caught up in that. And then this happened, and then that happened, and then that person, you know. And it's all story. It's all made up because none of it's really true. You know, we don't know what the real truth is necessarily. So that's one little thing that I come back to. But I love Pema Chodron's I'm the sky and the rest is weather. Thank you for that too.
Thank you, Sue. Yeah, it's like all those stories we tell ourselves over and over and over and over, sometimes thousands of times we've told ourselves the same story with slight variations. All they do is, especially because a lot of the stories have to do with something that we're not happy about, is we're recreating the suffering. We're recreating the painful experience that story thing. And in recreating it, we're creating our own suffering, literally creating our own suffering. And so, one skillful thing you can do to help work with that is, and I've done this with several of my favorite stories about things, is actually give them a name. And then there you are, there's that story starting to roll, and you can go, oh, it's that mother story. And sort of laugh at yourself that here I am telling myself the crazy story again. And just that giving it a name and laughing at yourself often takes the sting away and dissipates the story quite quickly sometimes. Sometimes the story's got to run anyway, but at least while it's running, now I'm laughing instead of suffering, which is also a good place to be. Okay. I have, as always, two last things to do. One is I have to read some poetry. A Dharma talk wouldn't be complete without a piece of poetry. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And I love this. This is a beautiful little poem that is a sort of a wonderful description of life, I think. It's called Song of the Builders. On the summer morning, I sat down on the hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. It was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy! How humble its effort! Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our inexplicable ways, building the universe. That's all we can do. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.